بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، والصلاة والسلام على سيد الأنبياء والمرسلين وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين وأصحابه الغر الميامين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تعالى في كتابه الكريم: إن سعيكم لشتى. وقال أيضا في كتابه الكريم: هل يستوي الذين يعلمون والذين لا يعلمون؟ وقد قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم: إنما بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق. So this is the presentation on sacred masculinity with that question mark at the very end. I am Bilal Muhammad, as you all know. And I'm going to be giving kind of a review of what's become a more popular topic in our circles. And you can see that just from the numbers. Gender. Since 2010 or so, gender's been one of the most hot button topics in our circle, not just in the Muslim sphere, but also around the world. Over here, you can see a graph of a steadily climbing. This is actually from Google Trends. So you can see how often a term is used. And in this case, gender, it's being used more and more. The term LGBT, I use Google Trends as well. And you can see, this is of course the acronym: lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual. Again, something that's on the rise as a topic of discussion, as a topic of debate, as a topic of exploration, of academic interest. Transphobia as well, of course, something that is happening, something that's being discussed, something that is a term that maybe some of us never even were familiar with 10, 20 years ago, but has become a topic of conversation. And this is not just on Google, but even on my own page analytics, I'm able to see how many people reply and view my posts. And of course, I post on a whole range of things. I post on monotheism, I post on self-help, on pop psychology, I post on really just about anything. I mean, I'm kind of a jack of all trades, master of none. I'm the Joe Rogan of the Muslim sphere, but of course, written word. And as you can see here, one in six, like if you look at the topics, the ones that are most popular, the one that has 6,500 views or reach, organic reach, compared to all the posts is, of course, the one about Generation Z, and about one in six adults in Generation Z identifying as LGBT. Or for example, this post over here that has 6,900 reach, compared to the other ones, you know, this one is about how popular customs might affect the sacrifices that we make. And I gave the example of fashion and high heels, something that's very inconvenient and painful. But because it's something that is popular, it sometimes affects the way that we act and the way that we behave and the sacrifices we're willing to make. And the list goes on. I did a post on khimar, it got 43,000 views. While a post on prayer, 1,900. So you can see that there's this huge discrepancy. And you've actually found that there are actually quite a few Muslim pages and Muslim influencers and Muslim personalities that are increasingly discussing femininity, masculinity, hijab, LGBT, the trans issue, gender. It's a cultural thing, it's a global thing that there's this interest on this topic. And so, of course, today's topic, masculinity. And this is going to be actually a critique, as the description says, of neo-masculinity and identity politics in Muslim circles. So first of all, what is identity politics? Okay, does anybody know? Does anyone want to share their definition if they have one? Okay, I mean, sorry, this is just, I'm a teacher by trade, right? So I'm used to just passing the mic on to students. So, but I realize that actually you guys are here for a presentation, so maybe I should be doing the speaking. But anyway, so identity politics is being able to view political events, economic events, social events through the lens of what you call your identity. And so we can see in the background, there's a feminist identity, so the experience of women in politics or the experience of women in society, what it's like to grow up in the West, in the East, et cetera, as a woman, or as a gay person, or as a white person, or as a Black person, or as a member of a social class or economic class. So, I mean, that's basically what it is. It's grievance studies. It's viewing the world and trying to discover who you are and what you should be. Of course, our identity, and this is something that I've discussed quite a bit on our page, on my page rather, Mr. Bilal Muhammad, that the identity of a Muslim is not an identity that's rooted in accidents. It's an identity that's rooted in something more transcendental than that. When you think about who you are, I mean, that's a very fundamental question. Who are you? Who am I? Right? And, you know, you might say that, well, I'm Syrian, I'm Canadian, but is that something that's an accident, or is that essential to who you are? Is there a time before you got the Canadian passport or citizenship? Is there a time where perhaps you weren't belonging to us, where maybe the borders of a certain nation have changed, in which case your identity would be something else? Well, then you might say, well, I identify as my sexual orientation. But did you always have that sexual orientation? Were you always sexually active, even as when you were a child? You know, this is an important question when thinking about who you are on a fundamental, essential level. You might say, well, I'm a human. That's my identity. I'm a humanist. But even then, was there not a point where you were an embryo, a sperm, a zygote? Is there not going to be a point at some point where you're going to be a corpse? You know, so really, when you get down to the most essential level, you are a creation. You are a creation. That's something that you always are going to be. It's something that you've always been. And it's something that you cannot get out of. You are limited in that. Okay? You're limited in the space that you can take. You're limited in the directions that you can go. You're limited in your strength. You're limited in your weight. You're limited in your height. You're limited in your knowledge. You're limited in your power. And that's the fundamental truth that Islam as a process brings us towards. It brings us towards real, true knowledge of self. And the self is in contrast to the creator, where I might have a limited power, but the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is al-jabbar, al-qawi, the one who is powerful, the one who is exercising that power. I might be knowledgeable or not knowledgeable, but I am not al-alim. Right? That is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is the all-knowing. I might be able to see and listen, but I'm not al-sami' al-basir. And so our limits, our confines only highlight the excellence and the majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as a creator. So that's kind of the essential Muslim identity. And it's represented in submission. It's represented in accepting who you are, accepting that you can't be everything at the same time. You can't be bigger than life. Life has a beginning and life has an ending. Your creation has a beginning and your creation has an ending. We all have a height and a width. Okay? And that without Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we would not exist, we would not subsist, and we would not be able to take a further step. Now, the question of who we are is a question that is social and political and philosophical. And of course, the topic of gender in that puzzle is a topic that has political considerations. So the political left increasingly favors a social constructionist model in analyzing gender. So gender, according to the left, is defined by society. It's defined by individual agency. It's how you feel. And then, so sexism for feminists on the left is an exercise of power on the part of the patriarchal institutions in society that were established to gain control. The binary, this is according to the left, the binary heteronormative culture comes from a bygone Eurocentric era. Okay, it comes from European ideas that are outdated, that masculine traits, feminine traits, that they are Victorian demarcations. And this is, of course, a discourse on the left. And so the solution to this that's proposed is to maximize individual freedom so that the individual then decides what to do and how to behave without those social barriers. Now, the new right, the what's sometimes called the alt-right or the alt-light or the new right or what have you, on the other hand, they're engaged in a critique of the constructionist model. And so they will use arguments from biology, including evolutionary biology. They'll use arguments from psychology. They'll use arguments from genetics. They'll use arguments from tradition and culture to emphasize that, again, to them, to the right, currently, gender is genetic. It's XY or it's XX. It's men are from Mars, women from Venus. It's that men and women are different, that society has always treated them differently, and that they'll use the contemporary kind of currency of science to bolster that argument. And of course, evolutionary biology here, in some cases, will be used to inform us on what male and female nature are. So you're kind of stuck in between these two. And the thesis is, you know, nurture, the antithesis is nature, and there's pressure on us to contextualize our politics into this dichotomy. The problem with the nature-nurture frame, of course, is that it can only attempt to describe how humans are. It can only point out to what is. It cannot answer what ought to be done, because ought is a moral question. It's what one ought to do in one situation or another. It transcends questions of culture or biology. And certainly culture and biology can relate to the ought. And even in the Sharia, there are considerations on what is urf and what urf should do or what we should do in a particular urf. But they don't define the ought, what we ought to do. And in some cases, we ought to do something that is agreeable to our culture and our nature. And in other cases, we ought to do something that conflicts with our culture and our nature. So what people ought to do, it depends on what your objective truth claim is. Our truth claim is that God exists. The universe without a God is incoherent and fallacious. God defines the ought in what we ought to do in situation A or situation B. Nature or nurture may be related to the ought, but they don't produce the ought. Allah has the agency to legislate something that goes with our nature, and He has the agency to legislate something that goes against our nature. So for example, Allah wanted Ibrahim alayhi salam to sacrifice his only son. Is that nature? Is that with nature? Is that against nature? Even in the institution of marriage, you know, is there a natural reason why the limit of partners is 4 and not 5 or 3? Is there a natural reason why children typically have gone to the father in fiqh, okay, in the event of a divorce, when, you know, maybe nature would dictate that the woman is, you know, hormonally tied to the children in some way? Is it natural for a woman to commit herself to one man for her whole life? Again, the way we answer these questions in morality may go against A, the instincts of a person or people, or B, the customs that they've constructed. And that's fine. Allah is our owner. There's no contradiction. He does with his possession whatever he pleases. And Islam is the process of learning that submission, because ultimately that trust, we know that God is a gracious God. We know that God does not wrong his creation, and we know that he does not oppress it. So God fulfills his promise. Okay, nature and nurture. Now, the serial killer Charles Manson once said, "There are no rights and wrongs, only is's." This may look cold-blooded to us, but it is really the only outgrowth of the absence of an objective truth. To quote from David Bentley Hart, there are today a number of quite morally earnest philosophers, especially in continental Europe, who are perfectly content to identify themselves as nihilists, because they understand nihilism to be no more than the rejection of an idea of an ultimate source of truth, transcendent of the self or the world, a rejection, that is, not of the various objective truths that can be identified within the world, but of the notion that there is some total or eternal truth beyond the world, governing reality and defining the good, the true, the beautiful for all of us here below. People are frantically looking for something to anchor themselves in, stable themselves in, stable their morality in. And if not organized religion, then what? Maybe the harm principle? And if the harm principle is too subjective or too hedonistic, then maybe they organize themselves in accordance to their nature, the hypothetical nature. Rajman bil ghayb, the Quran says. It's taking wild shots in the dark without any solid grounding. So in a time of a plurality of truths, this is your truth, this is my truth, identity politics has become a convenient way to define experience. The woman's experience has certain defining characteristics and grievances and issues. Person of color experience has also certain characteristics and grievances and issues. The gay experience also has certain issues. Interestingly, there's no real discussion on telos, which is the potentiality of each person or each identity group. That part is left vague, mostly, for most identity ideologies. But it has a prominent role in the neo-masculine thought that we're going to get into, inshallah. Because the telos in the neo-masculine thought is the alpha male. And again, we're going to get into that shortly, inshallah. But identity politics is basically a form of tribalism, asabiyya. The fractioning of society into billiard balls, one red, one blue, one striped, one solid, where we take an accidental characteristic, I'm using accident in the philosophical sense, and we make that the lens by which we view the world and world events. So over here in Toronto, we have graduations at the University of Toronto that are Black graduations. We have graduations that are non-Black graduations. And that's not a form of segregation, that's a form of choice, because celebrating Black excellence. You have spaces where whites are not welcome. Nationalism itself is a form of identity politics, right? Because nation state, right, it's taking an accident, which is race or ethnicity, which may very well have, you know, real world consequences, but it creates some level of segregation and division where conflict is inevitable when you bring two different parties that come together. In Medina, you had the Aus and the Khazraj. And then later you had the Muhajirin and the Ansar. And while the Prophet emphasized unity under principle, now it's not the Aus and the Khazraj, but it's men and women, okay, who are increasingly unable to get along, increasingly having difficulties in the workplace, increasingly having different views than one another, increasingly in conflict. But what I've noticed over the last number of years is the growing popularity of identifying with masculinity as a type of reaction to feminism, which, you know, affects the sisters. And there are more speakers and more influencers that want to reclaim and redefine masculinity, manhood, the men's rights movement. There are courses being sold on sacred masculinity. And that's all well and good until you start to notice that A, there's a level of this, it's just identity politics. And B, there's an unclear epistemology on how and why masculinity and femininity is being defined in a certain way. And C, the Muslim neo-masculinity movement is just taking notes from an existing non-Muslim neo-masculinity movement, or men's rights movement, or red pill movement, or manosphere, there's other names for it, and often just adding the Islamic stuff on top of it. making a few edits in the doctrine, but overall rebranding it and issuing it to the Muslim masses. The chicken and the egg, to me, is clear, and so I'll be delineating it here shortly. Of course, the Prophet ﷺ warned us about following what the previous nations had done. لَتَتَبَّعُونَ سُنَّةَ مَنْ كَانَ قَبْلَكُمْ بَاعًا بِبَاعًا وَذِرَاعًا بِذِرَاعًا وَشِبْرًا بِشِبْرًا حَتَّى لَوْ دَخَلُوا فِي جُحْرِ طِبَّ دَخَلْتُمْ فِيهِ. You will certainly follow the ways of those who came before you, arm's length by arm's length, forearm's length by forearm's length, hand span by hand span, until even if they entered a lizard hole, you will enter it too. And they asked, who, the Jews and the Christians? And he said, who else? Alayhi salatu wasalam. So just as the feminist movement appeared in the Muslim community, a type of Meninist counterpart has appeared. So I'd like to define first neo-masculinity. And I will put the definition forward by Rouge Valizadeh, who coined the term. Rouge Valizadeh is a pickup artist turned writer, social critic, and more recently, Orthodox Christian. He recently shut down his neo-masculine blog, Return of Kings, which was part of his manosphere, where authors shared realist, red-pilled views on gender. Quote, neo-masculinity, this is definition. Neo-masculinity combines traditional beliefs, masculinity, and animal biology into one ideological system. Period. He says that the neo-masculine male must have game, that's number one, which is attractiveness, quote, attractiveness in the eyes of women. Neo-masculinism reaffirms traditional sex roles. Which tradition, though, is a good question. Through arguments from evolutionary biology, quote, humans purportedly diverged from chimpanzees 4 to 8 million years ago. During that stretch, natural selection has applied different pressures on the men and women of our hunter-gatherer ancestors to increase their likelihood of survival. The idea of gender equality is a myth, this is still his quote, that has no scientific basis. Neo-masculinism tries to define, quote, the true nature of women, who he says in the same article, by 30 are considered past their peak beauty and fertility. We're going to explore that. And then try to latch onto a provider male, of course, a beta male, who is also a provider. Neo-masculinism may have, this is my opinion, neo-masculinism may have an intersection with anarcho-primitivism, which is a political ideology that advocates a return to pre-civilized or pre-agricultural ways of life. Hence, there's this constant recollection of the hunter-gatherers and hunter-gatherer societies, where men were hunters and women were gatherers. Men were split into two camps, alpha males and beta males. Alpha males are strong, they're assertive, they're warrior-like, while the beta males are weak and passive and harmless. That's the dichotomy that they create. So neo-masculinity, as an antidote to beta-ism, promotes self-improvement, that every man should aspire to be an alpha male. And the alpha male is defined by what? Number one, what women find attractive. Number two, survival skills in a hunter-gatherer type society. And so thus one's masculinity is improved in this literature by weightlifting and fitness and of course testosterone. A quote, being a man is not a social construct. It's primarily a biological construct that is heavily dependent on healthy body and brain functioning that results from appropriate testosterone levels. And so there's an emphasis on hard work ethic. Now, guys, I mean, like any ideology, there's going to be a kernel of truth, right? There's going to be a kernel of truth in this. Every ideology, including, you know, Marxism, has a kernel of truth. But all ideologies magnify certain ideas, they minimize certain ideas, they muddy certain ideas. And the goal of any ideology is to be seen not as the ideology. In other words, they want to be seen as just mathematical, rational, true, pure bookkeeping. In many respects, neo-masculinity is a response to feminism. Of course, neo-masculinity is more prominent on the right, or the more socially conservative circles in the West, while feminism is more prominent on the left, or socially liberal circles in the West. Neo-masculinity grounds itself in nature and tradition, while feminism grounds itself in nurture and individual agency. Let's move on to Muslim. Of course, all of this is taken from the website. This is Roosh V's website. You can search what is neo-masculinity and you'll find the article. So let's move on to the Muslim version of this. Let's not act like the Muslim circles are free from the infiltration of foreign ideas. This has been happening today, and really it's been happening since day one. Even during the Prophet's time, there were those in Medina who wanted to practice Jewish customs while being Muslim. So the Prophet established the fiqhi principle of tashabbuh bil kuffar, that Muslims were not to bring the customs of non-Muslims into Islam. And this is because Islam has its own unique paradigm. It's of surreal origins, unearthly origins, that cannot be adulterated by the appetite of hawa. In 2015, I called out the introduction of third wave feminist ideas in Muslim circles in a time where that was very unpopular. And I got a lot of heat for it. But now, however, it's become commonplace to find such critiques. But it's rare to find a Muslim who can even define new masculinity, even though its ideas have certainly reached us. It's reached all of us. And it's been around since at least 2010. So I wanted first to demonstrate how new masculinity has entered the Muslim sphere. I've erased any names in these pictures because I'm not interested in engaging with personalities. I'm interested in engaging with ideas. I will let other people engage with personalities. I'm just not interested. But these are all from popular influencers, sheikhs, people that wouldn't want to be called mainstream, but really they've become a type of new mainstream in this echo chamber era. So first, there's a proliferation of the term alpha, becoming the alpha Muslim, Muslim alpha men course. You know, when men were real. So this is from an actual, like these are from actual blogs. This is not my creation. So these are courses that are being sold to teach Muslim men how to be Muslim alpha males. So this is another label. It's another label, rather. It's another identity taken from the manosphere, which likes to divide men as either alphas or betas, or as alphas, which are chads, or cucks, which we'll get into. So what is the alpha male? I mean, what would that even be in Arabic? I don't even know. But you know, rajul awwali, I don't know. The term itself is just too firmly rooted in other concepts. Darwinian concept of survival of the fittest. It's a term that was cultivated in the worldview that sees humanity as a glorified chimp. Even if we wanted to say that the alpha-beta dichotomy came out of the hunter-gatherer period, we should ask ourselves, do we agree with the hunter-gatherer thesis? Which, you know, says that humans were hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years until just recently when we began to figure out how to put seeds in the earth. Because even in archaeology, even in the last 10 years, we don't have much time to get into it, but there is new evidence that makes civilization much older. We don't even have time to discuss it, but you can look up the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, which is a proposed cataclysmic event that happened roughly 13,000 years ago, which may have ended an existing civilization. So much of a previous civilizational order may have been wiped out or gone underwater, giving the illusion that humans were hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years, when that may not necessarily be the case. But the alpha male in the midst of most, or rather in the mind of most, neo-masculine circles is a very Germanic Viking type person, you know, this brave, tall, muscular man with six pack and women can't resist him. But the ideal man in other cultures is different, like in the Mediterranean culture. It's not necessarily the same. And the ideal white collar man may be different than the ideal blue collar man. I think we agree. But on the bright side, the neo-masculine Muslims, they see the Prophet as the alpha male that all are to emulate, which is great. But A, they've engaged in a selective reading of the Prophet, which highlights certain aspects of his character and minimizes certain aspects of his character, which is the same thing that feminists do with the Prophet. So it brings us back to square one. And anecdotally, I have seen them even use hadiths, or they say that hadiths about men controlling their anger or being selfless, they'll say, oh, these are overused. When really there's no such thing as an overused ayah. There's no such thing as an overused hadith. Any ayah or hadith that we can manifest is great. But they say this because it clashes with their idea of an assertive or aggressive alpha male. The Prophet, in a sense, actually challenged the Jahili idea of masculinity, and he manifested aspects of jamal, of beauty, as well as aspects of jalal, by being modest. He had haya, he had khushu', he has hilm, so he was forbearing, he had sabr, so he was patient. He was sweet, he was beautiful, he was devotional, so submissive to Allah. Some have tried to restore the balance by selling courses like this one, the Spiritual Warrior Program. For a low, low price, this Sayyid will teach you how to be a man. The problem, of course, is that it is a confused amalgamation of Jungian psychology. You can see it in the description. Lover, Magician, Warrior, King. That's a book by Douglas Gillette. And again, the archetypes in psychology, they deal with is, not ought. Because psychology as a discipline is so intertwined with biology, with evolution. This Celtic knot t-shirt, ironically, is a unisex shirt as well. Of course, this program also brings aspects of the seerah and, of course, weightlifting. So the question becomes, what's the chicken and what's the egg? What are the presuppositions that are had when a program like this is created? And are we just Islamizing stuff rather than building it from the ground up? This next slide is an actual event that took place, feminism versus masculinism. I wish I was making this up. Next, the manosphere has its own terminology and phrases that it uses, like any movement or religion. Basically, anyone that challenges their ideas is called a cuck. The word cuck comes from the English word cuckold, which could be a verb, but not just a noun. It is an ancient word, but the word came back and used popularly on the internet in 2014 on 4chan. And ever since then, any man that takes a softer approach on women is called a cuck. Cuckoldry, of course, is something real, discussed in hadith. Okay? ثَلَاثَةٌ قَدْ حَرَّمَ اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِمَ الْجَنَّةِ مُدْمِنُ الْخَمْرِ وَالْعَاقُ وَالْدَّيُوثُ الَّذِي يُقِرَّ فِي أَهْلِهِ الْخَبَثِ. There are three whom God has forbidden paradise. One who's addicted to wine, an undutiful son, and a cuckold who agrees to his women folks' adultery. So the concept is Islamic, but the usage of the concept in application today is exactly how the neo-masculine movement uses it. So in this slide, a Muslim influencer uses the word dayuth to describe Muslim mosques with COVID-19 restrictions. In this context, the influencer is saying that these Muslims are unmanly. And since they're unmanly, they are cucks. But logic follows that if such a person really is a dayut, then they won't enter paradise. So really, more caution needs to be used before these terms are used. Because when you call someone a dayut, you're damning them to hell. Okay, so, I mean, they're using this interchangeably in the way that 4chan users are using it. So is this really Islamic? And now there's this event, which is actually happening today, coincidentally, on masculinity. This sheikh's lecture is actually called What Do Women Want in a Man? Again, having game is important to the neo-masculine movement. And so they teach you how to mold yourself to being the ideal attractive man to women. Just gonna let somebody in. But how Islamic is that thesis? That you should just be attractive? Because really the Islamic goal is, what does Allah want in a man? What women want in a man is, again, nature, nurture. It's not ought, it is. We live in a culture where following Islamic rulings may be unattractive rather than attractive. We may have to be okay with that. The hijab laws, for example, detract us from the opposite sex. Even inside a marriage, you may have to do things out of principle that your wife or husband may not find attractive. So really, we don't need a Dr. Phil, what do women want approach. We need, what does God want? Whether people like it or not, or find it attractive or not. The sheikh, of course, is a man. But maybe he's reporting based on what he's heard and experienced from women. I don't know. That's not the real problem. This influencer put up this very un-Islamic picture comment with the title, Thoughts. He, of course, covered his bases, so not to get criticism, as the Prophet did indeed marry all kinds of women, young, old, divorced, virgin, with children, without children. But the manosphere is full of this kind of rhetoric, that real men, alpha men, that they want something, and therefore that is what we ought to organize ourselves around. Okay? So what's the ideal age? Of course, the ideal age, according to Roush, is 30, or rather it isn't. It is not 30. He says that 30 is the age where women are past their prime, where they settle for a beta provider male. But I find it interesting that our bodies in paradise may exactly be 30 or above 30. That is according to this hadith. Okay? 30 or 33. So, دَخْلُ أَهْلُ الْجَنَّةِ الْجَنَّةَ جُرْدًا مُرْدًا مُكَحَّلِينَ أَبْنَاءَ ثَلَاثِينَ أَوْ ثَلَاثٍ وَثَلَاثِينَ سَنَة. So the people of paradise enter paradise at 30 or 33. So again, that's the peak. The Quran, of course, puts our peak at the age of 40. حتى إذا بلغ أشده وبلغ 40 سنة. That's the age 40, which may be the peak of our intellectual power more so than physical power. But it's an interesting point to mention as a point of contrast. Now, of course, I must concede a few things to the other side on the issue of masculinity. The first concession is that biological sex in Islam has an essential quality to it, meaning it is not an accident at the level of our height or skin color or age. Allah and His Messenger were clear in saying that our sex was determined before our birth, and that we would be resurrected in new bodies, male and female. So there is something transcendental about sex. Secondly, Islam is a dimorphic religion. This presentation is not making a case for a tabula rasa, Rawlsian individualism, because clearly men have rights and women have rights. Men have responsibilities and women have responsibilities. There is the concept of the Rabb al-Bayt, Lord of the House. The man does pay the expenses of the house. The man does need training so he can fight. And some of this is going to be built into our fitrah. This presentation is not a case for the idea that boys aren't boys. I'm not even saying that we can't have courses on sacred masculinity, but these things need to be coherent. They can't just rely on discredited narratives of history or biology, and they have to emanate completely and totally from Allah and His Messenger. So when something is not directly in the Quran and Sunnah, we have to at least move on to the scholars. And much of the Muru'ah and Futuwa literature, of course, Muru'ah means masculinity, Futuwa means chivalry, much of this will conflict with neo-masculinity. The hadiths and ancient references that describe Muru'a almost always work in opposition to the aggressive instincts of inner men. Were these aggressive tendencies aspects of Jahiliyyah? Or are they found in the very nature of men? This is a research question that I have that requires further meditation. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, إِنَّمَا بُعِدْتُ لِأُتَمِّمَ مَكَارِمَ الْأَخْلَاقِ. Surely I've only been sent so that I may perfect noble character. To end off, I have a hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى خَصَّ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ بِمَكَارِمَ الْأَخْلَاقِ فَامْتَحِنُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ فَإِنْ كَانَتْ فِيكُمْ فَأَحْمَدُوا اللَّهَ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ وَرَغَبُوا إِلَيْهِ فِي الزِّيَادَةِ مِنْهَا فَذَكَرَهَا عَشْرَةً الْيَقِينَ وَالْقَنَاعَةَ وَالصَّبْرَ وَالشُّكْرَ وَالْحِلْمَ وحسن الخلق خلق rather والسخاء والغيرة والشجاعة والمروءة. So he said, Allah distinguished his messenger, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, with noble characteristics, makarim al-akhlaq. So test yourselves, and if you have some of it, then praise Allah and wish for him to increase it in you. They are certainty, contentment, patience, gratitude, forbearance, beautiful character, generosity, protectiveness, courage, and chivalry. أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم إنه غفور رحيم. استغفر الله, استغفر الله, استغفر الله.